Life's better with an auto policy from American Family Insurance. No matter what dreams you're driving towards. That's because our expert agents will make you feel totally protected with the right auto coverage at the right price. You'll also save up to 23% when you bundle auto with home. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall. I've returned to Bogota, the capital of Colombia, and we're here at 2,600 meters close to the stars, having left the sweltering lowlands of Mompox behind. And this is episode 347 of the Columbia Calling podcast. We're gearing up for a massive demonstration here in Bogota. I believe it's on Wednesday. The Minga Indígena will join with FECODE and other unions. So please plan accordingly if you're in a major city. I expect that Bogota will be like always. The beginnings of every march will be fine up until around 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon when, well, the undesirables start to vandalize and, of course, destabilize any of the legitimate complaints and demonstrations against injustices and inequities in this country. So, of course, plan accordingly and stay safe out there. This week's interview is quite special. His name is Nico Vorobyov, and he's, well, I'll let him speak for himself in segment three. He's got an interesting story, an interesting book as well. I read it myself. And talking of books, how did you find last week's episode with Wade Davis? I'm still very, very pleased to have had someone of such notoriety on this show. Of course, read the book Magdalena River of Dreams as soon as you can. I've got an extra copy here for anyone who wants to borrow it in Colombia, in Bogota indeed. Please just reach out and first come, first serve. What else can I tell you? Well, we'll be back after the newscast with Emily Hart and then on to segment three with Nico Vorobyov here on this episode of the Columbia Calling podcast. And now a few words from this week's sponsor. Thank you again. And a special message from our sponsors this week, calling all U.S. citizens. Your vote counts. Even if you have never lived in the U.S. or haven't lived there recently, go to votefromabroad.org. That's votefromabroad.org today to request your ballot. Votes received from abroad make the difference in elections every year. If you have voting-related questions, you can use the red chat box on votefromabroad.org and someone will get back to you within a few hours. Don't delay. 15 states have already passed their registration deadlines. See if you are still eligible to register and request your ballot today. That's from votefromabroad.org. Thank you again.
I'm Emily Hart, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for the week of October 19th, 2020. The Indigenous Minga, a social protest, has reached Bogota from the southwestern city of Cali and is demanding a meeting with President Iván Duque. More than 4,000 indigenous people arrived hoping to establish a political dialogue on issues such as compliance with the peace accords, the voluntary replacement of illicit crops, and the suspension of mining concessions on their land. The demonstration is demanding action in response to the recent massacres and assassinations of social leaders, as well as the presence of armed groups in indigenous territories. The president has yet to respond directly to the protest. Ombudsman Carlos Camargo will be the mediator for an eventual meeting with the president and the leaders of the Minga. Camargo will meet with a government team to listen to the Minga's proposals before. That meeting will be attended by the Minister of the Interior and the High Commissioner for Peace, among other government officials. The FARC political party also announced that it will be joining the Minga, in protest against the number of former FARC guerrilla who have been murdered. The number, after more killings this week, now stands at 323 assassinations since the signing of the peace deals. After this week's murders, the Special Jurisdiction for Peace, the JEP, summoned several high-level officials of the Duque government to a government hearing to demand answers on the issue. Colombia's last standing guerrilla group, the ELN, reiterated their request for a ceasefire after a registered intensification of attacks. This ceasefire had also been urged by the UN and the Pope earlier in the year, though President Duque rejected the Security Council's demand for a global ceasefire in July. In a new open letter to the governments of Colombia and the United States, the ELN asked for a bilateral and temporary ceasefire in order to be able to better carry out the humanitarian work required to confront COVID-19. While in general in Colombia, cases are dropping and the reopening continues, there is some concern in the Department of Antioquia. Intensive care units are at 80% capacity and cases are on the rise. The municipality of Rio Negro has already declared a red alert because the occupancy rate of ICU beds has exceeded 90%. A second wave is predicted in the coming months countrywide. That was the week's newscast, and now a message from our sponsors. Calling all US citizens. Your vote counts, even if you've never lived in the US or haven't lived there recently. Go to votefromabroad.org today to request your ballot. Votes received from abroad make the difference in elections every year. If you have voting-related questions, you can use the red chat box on votefromabroad.org and someone will get back to you within a few hours. Don't delay. 15 states have already passed their registration deadlines. See if you're eligible to register and request your ballot today. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is the third segment of the Colombia Calling podcast, episode 347. I'm Richard McCall here in Mompox, Bolivar. My very special guest this week is in Bath. I think Bath is in Gloucestershire in the UK. I have been there, of course, but it's the West Country and they talk kind of funny. They've got great accents. I, in fact, went to university in the West Country, but further adrift. But his name is Niko Vorobyov and he is... Well, I mean, he's English, really, but he's an immigrant to England with a whole history behind him. And the reason he's on the show is not only that he got in touch with us, but he's got a fascinating story to tell. And we're going to kind of take the line of his book. Now, if you haven't heard of Niko Vorobyov, you should have done, because his book is called Dope World, Adventures in the Global Drug Trade. And I'm going to read what is written here on Goodreads about the book. It says, in this irreverent ode to gonzo journalism, one writer travels the globe to explore the use of recreational drugs in cultures around the world. And it opens up with the paragraph, after I got out of jail, I was determined to find out more about how the issue of drugs not only landed me there, but has shaped the entire world. Wars, scandals, coups, revolutions. I read every book, watched every documentary. I saved up to buy plane tickets. I went to Colombia, Mexico, Russia, Italy, Japan, and the Afghan border. All in all, 15 countries across 5 continents. Call me Narco Polo. Welcome on the Colombia Calling podcast, Niko.
Hola, Colombia. What's up, everyone?
Thank you for your time and thank you for sending me a copy of the book to read. I'll tell you all out there that it's an incredibly readable book. You could actually, despite the number of pages, because it's really big, but you could read it in one or two sittings very comfortably, I think. So, Niko, tell us a little bit about your past. I mean, you were born elsewhere, but then emigrated young to the UK, and then let's say that things kind of spiraled out of control.
Yeah. So, as you might be able to tell by my accent, I'm not a purebred Anglo-Saxon, shall we say. So I was originally born in St. Petersburg. It was then called Leningrad back in the old days of the USSR, the Soviet Union. And I don't remember exactly when we left because I wasn't very tall then. But at some point we left to America and Italy and back to Russia and then to England because at the time, you know, the USSR was collapsing. There was a huge financial crisis, and obviously my parents wanted to get the best opportunity for themselves and for me that they could. So eventually we ended up in Bath in Britain, and I was always because we moved around so much and I was little, so America, Italy, Russia, I was always the new kid in school. Mm-hmm. You know, so I I had a lot of trouble fitting in and stuff. I had a lot of self-confidence issues. So whereas others might have channeled that energy more positively, I took to a life of crime. But unfortunately for me, I'm too much of like a nice guy, or too much of a coward, maybe some might say, to actually go around and rob anyone. So the thing that was my thing, first I started out with pirated DVDs. Mm-hmm. So this is before everyone discovered the internet and how to torrent stuff. I was just like people gave me their orders. I would rent that DVD out or download it myself and then copy it for them. For a small fee, of course. Mm-hmm. And then when that expired, I kind of turned to drugs. So my main thing, so Bristol is, it's pretty much the drum and bass. Bristol is next to Bath. It's mm-hmm. bigger city next to Bath. It's pretty much the drum and bass capital of the UK, the electro music capital. And every weekend, pretty much, there was an illegal rave going down. It's like one of those illegal kind of trance music parties, usually somewhere in the woods or the hills or a field or a warehouse, like this abandoned warehouse or something like that. So I went around there every weekend with a big bag of weed and ecstasy, and I went around selling that, and it was pretty good. I made a lot of friends. I pretty much quadrupled the investment I made on the ecstasy originally, but not without trouble. Mm. So at one point, at one party, I ended up getting robbed and stabbed. It wasn't like a fate. Actually, it's kind of a funny story. Well, not funny then, but funny now looking back at it. Because I knew I'd been in a fight, obviously, but I didn't know that I'd been stabbed. Because first, like, my adrenaline's going. And secondly, because the knife actually cut my nerve endings in my leg. Mm. So I literally couldn't feel any pain. And I only realized I'd been stabbed afterwards when we were, like, walking towards home. I heard this like squishing sound coming from my shirt. I looked down and just the whole left side of my body is red and the blood just filled the shoe, which is pouring out of the shoe now. And that's the point where I thought, okay, maybe I should get that looked at. So that really, that should have been kind of the warning for me to quit. But, you know, I was still young and still pretty stupid. And so I actually scaled up my operation. So by the time I ended up going to university in London, I actually had like three or four guys kind of doing rounds for me. So I was essentially like the wholesaler. I'm not like some kind of kingpin or anything, but I was probably like the biggest dealer at my university campus. So let's put it that way.
Okay.
And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending how you look at it. So for us criminals, we have to get lucky every day. The police only have to get lucky once. They need to catch you slipping up that once. So one time I very stupidly, even though I always told my customers, don't take anything on the tube, there are police dogs on the tube. But one day I was in a rush and I took the stuff on the tube. So tube is, to any like Americans listening, it's what we call the metro or the underground in London. So I took some stuff with me there at that time, just like a little bit to pass on to my friend. But they caught me, and that was enough for them to search my apartment, which is how I ended up in jail, which is how I ended up looking into all this stuff, which is why we're talking right now.
So you were caught with your stash, I guess, ecstasy and marijuana again, and then jail. But it was young offenders jail or adult jail?
So first of all, I should probably say what exactly I got caught with. So I had like 3 grams of ecstasy with me, or MDMA rather, but let's just call it ecstasy. But they're in 0.5 gram wraps, so it looked like I had 6 little wraps. So whereas I could have blagged 3 grams, that's for my personal use, but six, if it looks like 6 grams, then like clearly I'm an enterprising young man. So they found that on me. Then at my apartment, they found a about a kilo of marijuana and about an ounce of MDMA and a few grams of cocaine. Like, cocaine wasn't really like a big business of mine, but it was more like a hobby. Anyway, so I went to there's two kinds of prison in Britain. There's a category B prison, which is like category A is for like this most serious like terrorists, like serial killers, like high risk, high escapee risk, things like that. B category is like a holding prison where you're going to be sentenced or whatever, and they don't know what to do with you yet. C cat is like the standard one, and D cat is like an open prison. So that's like, I tried to get into an open prison once, but they lost my paperwork, and that never happened in the end. But basically, an open prison, sometimes you can leave for work and stuff, and you just have to, it's like an involuntary hostel. So I was first in a BCAT prison, and then I was in a CCAT Young Offenders, which is 18 to 25. Huh. But there was one 28-year-old there by mistake who was pretty angry about it. And I think the Young Offenders prisons, they're actually a lot more kind of volatile. Because when I was in the BCAT prison and I was with all the, like, the big men of the criminal world, like, nobody really wants to mess with each other because they know the consequences can be serious. They just want to kind of do their time and go home with like as little fuss as possible. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the Young Offenders prison, you got all these kind of like wannabe gangbangers or actual gangbangers who all want to like mess with each other for no real reason other than they're just a bunch of angry young men locked up together. So fights will break out over like the stupidest stuff.
And so these experiences on the inside, how long were you in again for, quickly?
So I got a 2.5-year sentence originally, but I got out in a year and a little bit. I got out early because I was a good boy and I didn't start any fights.
Okay. You got out and this inspired you to do the investigation which has resulted in this book, which is, I would say, you know, again, a conversationally written but incredibly well-researched compendium of drugs, laws, and errors around the world. I mean, you as you said, 15 countries, and your experience has led you to be, I suppose, quite a strong advocate for the legalization of all drugs.
Yeah, more or less. I have become a little bit more kind of nuanced over the years. So I used to be a kind of legalize everything, hell yeah kind of guy. I realized like in practice, it depends on what we're talking about. I think all drugs like for personal use should be decriminalized. So everything like, including like crystal meth or GHB or whatever. So if you have something just for yourself, I think that should be a crime in and of itself. So kind of like how it is in Portugal. So first of all, hardly anyone in Portugal gets caught by the police for personal possession because the police aren't even looking for that. It's not a priority. Mm. But those that do, they end up going before a like a psychiatrist and a social worker, not a judge. Like, it doesn't appear on their criminal record or anything. It's like getting a parking ticket, essentially. As for legalization, I think it would depend what we're talking about. So I think something like marijuana should be legalized for sure across the board, the same way that alcohol is. I think there can be kind of little nuances how it should be sold. It's like dispensaries or like they have in the Spanish cannabis club system. I think ecstasy should also be legalized. I think when you get something like cocaine, it's a bit more tricky because cocaine compared to the others really does have a lot of bad consequences for your health and how you behave. But I think that there's actually in Colombia, they're exploring this option. I didn't think it's going to pass, but I read that there's some opposition politicians put forward a bill essentially legalizing cocaine. So you could buy, you have to register and you can buy like a gram a month or a week, sorry, from a licensed pharmacist. So I think I could see something like that working maybe. I mean, I'm not a doctor, so my word shouldn't be considered bond in this case. But I think that sounds like a reasonable, from my non-medical perspective, it sounds like a reasonable option that should be considered. And things like heroin, so countries like Switzerland and the Netherlands, and they're actually beginning to try it again here in the UK. They've had a lot of luck prescribing heroin and allowing it to be injected in special clinics. So I think that's a very, based on like the statistics from Switzerland and how they've managed to reduce crime and HIV transmission, that's another very promising thing to look into.
Yeah. Now this bill in Colombia, yes, I think it's I know of it. I'm fairly certain under the current administration and their different allies that it will be shot down. But that there is a conversation taking place is always positive, especially in a country like Colombia where the stigma runs so deep and for obvious reasons. Now, in your adventures and in your investigations, obviously Colombia plays a huge part, and Colombia is known, unfortunately, and of course justifiably, as a major producer of cocaine. We had author journalist Toby Muse on the show some months ago with his new book Kilo, and he a lot of anecdotes and stories about almost like he follows pretty much a brick of cocaine from its production as the leaves being picked off coca to the final purchase almost. And the book is a very good book, but Colombia's known for this. So you, how long did you spend in Colombia investigating, let's say the trade and the people involved in the trade?
Altogether, it was probably a couple of months, but I didn't do it like all at one time. So the first time I went was like for a month, and then I came back around New Year's 2019 for another month. So,
yeah. So you took in a cocaine kitchen or a laboratory somewhere, and you also spent time with some of the reintegrating guerrillas. You asked them about their involvement in it, and then you saw the other side of things, where you saw the sort of Escobar's former hacienda Napolis. Can you tell us a little bit about these three experiences?
Right. So I would frame all of these experiences as a very kind of peculiar form of tourism, yeah. which they all are in a way. Let's start with Pablo Escobar stuff. So there's especially, I'm not sure because I wasn't in Colombia before 2016, but I know for sure like since Narcos started, there's been a lot of interest in Pablo Escobar and his life, and for better, I understand how it would annoy a lot of Colombians that rich tourists are coming there for that purpose. But that's the fact of the matter, is that he has brought a lot of macabre interest in Colombia, and there's all these tours, especially in Medellin, where you can kind of meet his brother, go to like the Barrio Pablo Escobar, like the neighborhood that he built for the poor. And but for me, the most, like, the experience that stuck most in my mind was his old ranch, the Hacienda Napolis, which is about halfway between Medellin and Bogota, if I remember correctly. It's like a little drive, like 3 or 4 hours drive either way.
Yeah. Puerto Triunfo.
And it's a very strange place, because a lot of the stuff, like when I was there, a lot of the Escobar stuff was still there. So you go in and you ride through to the visitor center, and there's all these kind of huge fake dinosaurs everywhere, like a kind of pseudo Jurassic Park. And you'd think that this is something that that the new owners built there, because the new owners are trying to make it into a safari park, like a sort of family destination place. But no, apparently Escobar put all those dinosaurs there. That was his idea. And he had a lot of he was so rich he actually had his own private zoo on the property. And now it's like become an actual zoo, so they've I'm not sure how many of the animals are like there originally from Escobar's day. But now it's turned this kind of odd zoo safari park with like little leftovers of the old narco days. So you still have the plane hanging over the entrance, which is the first plane he used to smuggle his first load of cocaine into America. You still have like the landing strip where the planes used to land carrying like coca paste from Bolivia and Peru and then onto the Caribbean. It's a very strange experience, like the sort of the narco family theme park. Mm. The other thing is, the next one I want to talk about is the rebels.
Yeah.
The FARC rebels. So, I mean, I'm not sure how, like, I'm not sure if this is still happening now with COVID, but as of about 2 years ago, so as part of the peace deal, which was signed in 2016 with the FARC rebels, they got to live in these sort of demobilization camps. So not all of them would have wanted to go to, or most of them, I know about most of them, but a good deal of them wouldn't have wanted to go back to civilian life because they're just so used to like the guerrilla lifestyle, you know? So they wanted to live with their comrades in these special camps. And also because it's dangerous for them to live in the city, you know, because there's a lot of animosities towards them. You also have like the paramilitaries who are after them. So if they stay in this camp, it's kind of safer and more familiar for them. Well, obviously, they still need money. They might be communists, but they still need money. So one thing they started doing is you could go on these tours, these eco tours, they call them, to the FARC camps. And it's a little bit, it's kind of a mission to get to them because they don't advertise. So I had to go to the city where I knew there was a camp and then call up the local tourist board. Then they gave me a number and... But you can go, like anyone can go there. You can actually even stay there. You can sleep over in like a recreation of the kind of camp that they would have stayed in. So there, you can sleep on a bed of leaves, which is surprisingly comfy. And they're very candid about their experiences as well. Having said that, I know what the situation is now because I imagine like coronavirus has hit the tourist business pretty hard.
Oh yeah.
And also at the same time, you have like the peace deal. I'm not sure like what the current status is, but I know a lot of former guerrillas are now taking up arms again because they're not happy with how they've been treated by the government. So I'm not sure what the situation there now is. And actually, in fact, a few months after I came back, I heard that while they were out, gunmen attacked a young couple from the camp. They opened fire on them as they were out of the camp, and they actually killed their baby, which is only a few months old. So yeah, it's just a reminder that, you know, this it's not like some abstract, like weird tourist thing that's happening. It's also part of their lives. Like it's something they have to live with, being guerrillas. Mm-hmm.
This was a couple that you knew.
I don't remember if I met them because I'm very bad with names.
Okay.
And it didn't have their picture in the thing, but it was definitely that camp that I visited, and I later messaged the ex commander who was there, and he said that yeah, it was us, and we were all very.
No, is very this special. The camp in the north east of the country?
Yeah, it was near Venezuela.
Oh, so up in the Guajira area, Cesar Guajira area. Okay, very good. Yeah, and that's of course a very troublesome area as well. So sorry, go on. And the third point, we were going to talk about the cocaine kitchen, I think.
Yeah, so that's this isn't something that I recommend for your listeners or ethical travelers. However, I am not an ethical traveler, as you may have noticed. Yeah. But I'm not going to say where it is because it's illegal and I wouldn't want to get anyone in trouble, but there is a tour that is quite popular in backpacker circles in a certain city or town, should I say, where you can make your own cocaine, basically. Like, they show you the whole process from getting the leaves to pouring all the chemicals. There's some cement involved for some reason. Like, I didn't fully understand why cement was necessary for the reaction to make cocaine, but for some reason it is. And they take you out to this shack in the middle of nowhere, and they show you how it's all done. I just remember while I was there, I was tripping hard because I was thinking, just at any point, you know, an army helicopter is going to land. I'm going to try to make a run for it, but obviously I'm going to be up against trained soldiers, so I'm going to get caught. And then I'm going to have to make a very awkward phone call to my mother, like, "Mom, it happened again." I didn't think I'd get into, like, too much trouble realistically, but it was still a very, very sketchy experience. And later on, I remember I bumped into that tourist guide who gave me the tour. I bumped into him just randomly, because it's a small town, so chances you'll see someone quite high. And he just kept trying to stuff little cocaine vials in my pockets as a souvenir. Okay. I was like, no, like, I have to fly tomorrow. I have a plane. It was interesting. But yeah, there's a strong element of narco-tourism in Colombia. I imagine, like, some Colombians, especially like middle-class Colombians, would be quite angry about it, because they don't want to be known as like this capital of drugs and death. But I guess one way you could look at, first of all, it's the history of the country. So especially with the Pablo Escobar tours, tacky as they are, like, that's what happened, and you shouldn't try to escape from that. Secondly, there's an added benefit, you know. So I guess come for the cocaine, stay for the waterfalls, for the Lost City trek, for the music, for everything else. You know, the tourists might find something they're not expecting.
So we could perhaps deviate their interests, which is obviously so damaging to the country, and channel it towards the nature, the ecology, the culture, as you say, the music. It would be wonderful if this could be the case. I mean, I cannot, you know, obviously condone any type of drug tourism of this nature, although learning about the Escobar years and learning about what has happened to Colombia due to the money involved and in this business, I can see being important and being able to take that message back to places like the UK, in Bristol, London, or, you know, other major cities, you know, to say, listen, look at what's happened to these countries or this country due to this. I can see that as a very important message, despite Colombian people's obviously reticence and outright desire not to talk about it and not to be known for it. It's an unfortunate reality that, you know, I personally believe you can't turn your back on. But we can work together to get a message out. And I think through your book, you're getting you're addressing the message. You know, we need to discuss this more. We need to discuss the lunacy of a war on drugs. And that kind of brings me, is like, you sort of bring in the after leaving narco tourism and leaving a lot of your investigations from all over, you do bring in, and we point to, let's say, the Trump wall. All things point to the Trump wall with Mexico, which, yeah, it's not going to stop what he says it's going to stop. And you, as someone who's researched all of this far more than I have, and you know, far more than I know about this industry, it's just not going to stop a flow of drugs.
Yeah, regarding the wall, I don't think it might even happen, because we're like, it's the second election already, and like, I don't know if they've even built anything. I mean, I know that there are like fences between Mexico and America. Obviously, you have these pictures, you know, where you have between San Diego and Tijuana, where you just have slums on one side and like a suburb on the other. But I'm not sure how much progress they've actually made towards the wall. But yeah, it's not gonna do anything. Like, they'll always find the way out. And first of all, they dig tunnels. Like, that's like El Chapo broke that prison with a tunnel. And actually, he was the pioneer of digging tunnels. Like, usually it's they're not that long. They're like between like a safe house in San Diego and a safe house in Tijuana. But still, and there are so many other ways. You know, they could just fly a drone over. They could take it by boat. But at most drug shipments actually don't come with like all these elaborate kind of James Bond type smuggling plots. Most of it's just hidden along like legit produce. Just because there are so many legitimate border crossings each day, they would need to either check everyone by random, which is like how many thousands a day, or they need like intelligence knowing that specifically this shipment is going to come through in these avocados on such and such a day from such and such a company, you know? So it's impossible to stop. I mean, I guess there's an argument that it makes drugs harder to get, which reduces the harm, which I can kind of see. But then you have to weigh all that up against all the like unintended consequences. So destabilizing countries around the world, not just in Latin America, but you see it in Asia and Africa and even parts of Europe at various stages. And the consequence of people's health, it's much more dangerous to be a drug user under a prohibition, I guess, because there's no quality control. There's no telling what's in it. You know, it's like in America in the 1920s when they had prohibition, you had a lot of like bootleg moonshine that was just brewed up in someone's bathtub.
Yeah.
And like, you know, thousands of people went blind just drinking that. And it still happens today. When I was in Africa, there's still a lot of people drinking moonshine just because it's cheaper. And if you can read about a lot of places like in Africa and India, you have like these mass poisonings from a bad batch of moonshine. It's essentially the same thing.
Now, I'm interested about this. I know the moonshine is here. It's drunk here in Mompos, where I am now. It's called Nyeke. That would leave you blind. It's 6,000 pesos for a wine bottle's worth of Nyeke, and more than one person gets drunk on it. I mean, it's what the down and outs drink, and it leaves them pretty hindered at the end of it. Now, you are now known. Let's go back to Nico here. You are known for this book. It's got amazing reviews online on the Goodreads website and on Amazon. Dope World Adventures in Drug Lands, and you can find it on anywhere. Just look up. And you've written pieces in The Independent, in Vice magazine. You're now known as, let's say, a level-headed, I would say, expert in the field. I want to ask though, you know, this has now defined your life because you've obviously participated in recreational drugs. You've also been a dealer and you've traveled the world to learn more about the economics of the drugs. But would you have done it differently? I mean, would you have done your life differently had you known how it was going to turn out, time in jail, time in prison and so on? Give us a little bit of insight into Nico's thought process here.
Well, I've done it now because then I wouldn't be here now, you know. I mean, everything's led to this point. There's been ups and downs, but you know, now I have way more stories to tell at dinner parties. So it all comes together in the end. One question I get asked sometimes is, would I have carried on dealing if I hadn't been caught? I mean, like one of two things would have happened. Either I would have kind of, because basically my entire market at that point was pretty much concentrated around university students or people who hang out with university students.
Yeah.
So by the time everyone was graduating, my market was drying up. So either I can't see myself being like 25, 26 years old, still standing outside like the halls of residence, you know, smoking a spliff and trying to attract customers. So I would have moved more into wholesale and left that up to the young ones. Or I would just kind of would have gradually wound things down and stopped. That's actually what a lot of my all my friends who I know who are like in on it with me, they've all pretty much wound down and stopped, and they just live normal lives now. But they had the bonus of not having their lives disrupted by a spell at Her Majesty's leisure.
You don't think you would have graduated into sort of moving in city circles with, you know, city boys and so on? But that would have been like a next step from university, wouldn't it?
I was doing a little bit of that already, but I didn't think I knew enough of them to kind of get a hold of that market successfully, you know?
Yeah.
I think I might be able to now, but then now I'd have to start from scratch again, and it's not worth the effort at this stage.
In your travels, when your passport is scanned, is there a red flag that comes up for having spent time in prison, and does it, you know, I'm sure that some records are here and there, you know, and are visible to the immigration officials.
Originally I was told, I got caught once smuggling cigarettes from Ukraine. Mm. And I got told once that I was now on a customs blacklist. But since then, I've never been stopped by any customs officials in Britain. I've been stopped randomly in some other countries. That was clearly like a random stop, you know, because they have the quota of X many passengers they have to stop a day or whatever. I don't think that it's really a big deal. I haven't tried getting into the States yet. But when I went to Japan, I remember we had to fill out this landing. I might get in trouble for saying this, but let's hope the Japanese authorities don't listen to this podcast.
I have very few listeners in Japan. It's single single digits.
So they make you fill out this landing card, and one of the questions is, have you ever been convicted of a crime involving explosives, extremism, or banned substances? And I just ticked no. And I assume that's just to weed out the stupid criminals. That's the closest I've come to that. I haven't tried getting like a visa into the States or whatever, but I think realistically, unless you're wanted by Interpol or something, they have reason to suspect that you're lying, that they probably won't come up. I know I haven't tested this theory, and I'm not planning to in the near future though. So if any ICE agents are listening in, don't worry, you can sleep safe at night.
Unlikely. It's unlikely they're listening in. Very interesting, though, is because, of course, one forgets about the knock-on consequences potentially, especially in this. And now that you're writing about it, that's what interests me, is that now you're writing about it so openly, and you know it might put you on one of those lists. I don't. Who knows? Who knows? I'm curious to find out, and I hope not to be able to see you on a HBO program, sort of locked up abroad or whatever it is, and the ones that alert airports in Madrid or in Lima or Bogota. I don't want to see you up there getting pulled over and then having to admit to all sorts of different things. Now, so what's next then for you, Nico? You've written this book. It's got great reviews. I assume it's selling well. Are you happy with the returns?
You know what? Honestly, I haven't checked.
Okay.
Because I think if it's bad, then I don't want to know. But,
there are great reviews. There are great, very positive reviews.
We haven't had a bad review yet, which I'm happy about.
Now, so what's next on your list of things to do?
I would say that like last time I did ask about sales once, and that was like just a few months after it came out, and we'd sold 4,000 copies then, which isn't bad.
That's pretty amazing.
It's not bad. And that was in October. So since then, we've had the US release, we've had the paperback re-release, we've had a Dutch release, and we're going to have a Russian release soon if that doesn't get banned. Regarding what I'm going to do next, so I've got two two books in the works. So one of them is going to be called How to Break Out of Jail, and it's going to be like a compilation of different jailbreaks around the world and how they did it. So when I went to Mexico, I met El Chapo's family. So I'm going to talk about, I'll go back to Mexico, talk to them again, and find out some more about his escape with the tunnel and everything. I want to just do like criminals and stuff, though. I want to do like, for example, like escaping from a North Korean gulag as well, because, you know, sometimes they have like whole generations of dissidents, like the children of dissidents are locked up with the dissidents. So I think that could be an interesting angle to explore. And then I'm working on another book as well called, called Extremely Illegal, which is like a follow-up to Dope World. I want to do more parts of the world that haven't been explored so much, at least in literature. So more like Africa, Asia, the Netherlands, especially like the Netherlands, the ecstasy business there, it produces 80% of the world's pills. It's basically like, kind of like the Colombia of Western Europe, except much more peaceful. And also Bolivia, I want to go as well, because as your listeners may or may not have heard, there was like a, depending on your perspective, there was either a coup or a revolution last year. And now the new government's much more pro-US. And the last government, or the last two governments, sorry, they legalized coca growing, essentially. So I feel that could all get thrown under the bus with a new government. And yeah, that could be an interesting development as well.
Well, you're never a dull moment for you then. It's certainly got plenty on your plate. And I wish you all the best for these new books, and of course for continued sales of Dope World Adventures in Drug Lands, and thank you for getting in touch, and thank you for agreeing to share a lot of your knowledge, your thoughts and your experiences here on the Columbia Calling podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
You're most welcome. So out there, if any of you are interested in kind of a compendium of stories and anecdotes compiled by Niko Vorobyov, do buy Dope World Adventures in Drug Lands. The reviews are amazing. I've read it, and I read it in a couple of sittings. It's very, very readable indeed. So there it is out there for you. As he says, the paperback release, and it's being translated into different languages as well for those of you out there not native English speakers. So very interesting indeed. Thank you to Niko Vorobyov for his time. This has been episode 347 of the Columbia Calling podcast. We'll be back next week with more interesting people with interesting stories in the Columbia focus to them. I've been Richard McCall. Bye-bye. And a special message from our sponsors this week, calling all U.S. citizens. Your vote counts. Even if you have never lived in the U.S. or haven't lived there recently, go to votefromabroad.org. That's votefromabroad.org. Today to request your ballot. Votes received from abroad make the difference in elections every. And a special message from our sponsors this week, calling all U.S. citizens. Your vote counts. Even if you have never lived in the U.S. or haven't lived there recently, go to votefromabroad.org. That's votefromabroad.org. Today to request your ballot. Votes received from abroad make the difference in elections every year. If you have voting-related questions, you can use the red chat box on votefromabroad.org and someone will get back to you within a few hours. Don't delay. 15 states have already passed their registration deadlines. See if you are still eligible to register and request your ballot today. That's from votefromabroad.org. Thank you again. Year. If you have voting-related questions, you can use the red chat box on votefromabroad.org and someone will get back to you within a few hours. Don't delay. 15 states have already passed their registration deadlines. See if you are still eligible to register and request your ballot today. That's from votefromabroad.org. Thank you again.